Today's broadcast was originally recorded on July 15th, 2025.
Religious leaders can now endorse political candidates without risking their organization's tax-exempt status.
Well, not exactly. Not yet. But maybe soon.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
We'll discuss.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Oh,
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. Stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV. Out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, Delmarva FM, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Voters, God love them, took to the polls on Tuesday in a lively Democratic Party primary special election of the primary, Democratic Party primary, in Arizona's 7th congressional district to fill the seat vacated by the death of Democratic Congressman Raul Grijalva earlier this year. He passed away in March. Five Democrats are vying for that nomination to represent the very blue district that runs across most of the state's southern border with Mexico. It's just a huge district, at least land-wise, including portions of Tucson. Front runners in that contest include Grijalva's 54-year-old daughter, who is a former Pima County supervisor, endorsed by progressive independent Senator Bernie Sanders, a 25-year-old progressive media influencer endorsed by Parkland, Florida school shooting survivor turned political activist David Hogg, and a current 35-year-old state rep in a contest that is being seen more for its generational implications for the party rather than its politics per se, as most of the candidates sort of agree with each other politically.
Well, this should be very interesting to see how it all turns out.
It will. Three Republicans are also vying for their own party's nomination in that special election, but given the left-leaning nature of the district, the winner of Tuesday's Democratic primary is likely to go on to easily win the seat in September's special general election. Then again, that was also thought to be the case after New York City's recent Democratic primary for mayor, where former frontrunner and disgraced former state governor Andrew Cuomo lost the primary last month to the young, media-savvy Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani. But now Cuomo has announced his intentions to get back into the race in November as an independent candidate, apparently with the support of many Republicans who hope to defeat the affable Mamdani, who has promised populist progressive change for New York City. In any event, we will have any noteworthy results and our problem reports for voters in the Arizona special U.S. House election on tomorrow's broadcast. Speaking of elections, the Trump administration, you will be shocked to learn, appears to be hoping to corrupt them even further by halting enforcement of a 75-year-old law that has prevented churches from endorsing candidates from the pulpit, churches and other places of worship, as you may have heard last week when this story broke. But it is not quite as simple as that, according to my guest, a longtime veteran tax law professor. She will join us momentarily to explain. And in other disastrous news and other Arizona news, Desi Doyen will join us for our latest Green News report a little bit later.
Yes.
Amid continuing fallout from last week's deadly flash flooding in Texas and FEMA under DHS Secretary Kristi Noem's failure to respond in a timely manner, arguably at all in some cases.
Yep.
And you will also have news on a national park treasure that was lost over the weekend as wildfire season kicks into high gear at the same time, apparently, as flash flood season across a whole bunch of states this year.
Yeah, we basically have everything everywhere all at once this summer.
All the disasters coming together. But first, a few quick news headlines before we get to all of that. Inflation rose last month to its highest level since February as President Donald Trump's sweeping tariffs finally began to push up the cost of a range of goods, including furniture, clothing, large appliances, all as expected and predicted by many other, of course, than President Donald Trump. Consumer prices rose 2.7% in June from a year earlier, according to the Labor Department on Tuesday. That is up from an annual increase of 2.4% in May. That despite Trump's campaign promises that he would not only lower inflation, but in fact lower prices and costs for everything overall, not raise them. Trump had declared just days ago, as a matter of fact, that the U.S. effectively has no more inflation. Even as he pressures Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell to cut short-term interest rates, which, if you believe economists rather than Trump, would actually make inflation worse, not better. Yet the bump in inflation last month is triggered by Trump's trade policies now makes it more likely that the central bank will, in fact, not lower rates, at least for now, at the central bank's next meeting in 2 weeks. The uptick in inflation was driven by a range of higher prices. The cost of gasoline rose 1% just from May to June, while grocery prices increased 0.3%. Appliance prices jumped for the third straight month. Toys, clothes, audio equipment, shoes, sporting goods all got more expensive and are all, of course, heavily imported. So, yes, turns out you are paying those tariffs, not foreign countries, as Trump has been attempting to gaslight Americans for years. Quote, you're starting to see scattered bits of the tariff inflation regime filter in, said economist Eric Winograd, who added that the cost of long-lasting goods rose last month compared with a year ago for the first time in about 3 years. Quote, were it not for the tariff uncertainty, he said, the Fed would already be cutting rates. So good job, Donald Trump. He said the question is whether there is more to come, and the Fed clearly thinks there is more inflation to come, along with most economists who feel the same, given Donald Trump's continuing threats of increasing tariffs. For Democratic lawmakers, the inflation report confirmed their warnings over the past several months that Trump's tariffs would push up inflation. Their argument on Tuesday was that the situation will likely get even more painful given the size of the tariff rates. In the letters that Donald Trump has posted over the past week to a bunch of countries, quote, for those saying we have not seen the impact of Trump's tariff wars, look at today's data, said Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts. Americans continue to struggle with the cost of groceries and rent, and now prices of food and appliances are rising. Trump has imposed sweeping duties of 10% on all imports to the U.S. now, plus 30% on goods from China. Just last week, the president threatened to hit the European Union with a new 30% tariff starting August 1. 30% tariffs on Mexico, 35% tariffs on our friends to the north in Canada. He's also threatened to slap 50% duties on Brazil because, despite the fact that we have a trade surplus with Brazil, they buy more from us than we do from them, which is what Trump's idea of reasons for tariffs, his claims that the world is ripping us off because we're buying more from them than they are from us. Anyway, he's slapping these tariffs on Brazil, or threatening to, because the nation is attempting to hold Jair Bolsonaro, their former autocratic, very Trumpy leader, to criminal account for his attempt at stealing the last presidential election there with a January 6th styled coup. If those tariffs are enacted, it would push up the costs of orange juice and coffee, as orange prices have already leapt 3.5% just from May to June here, as Trump has targeted migrant workers, farm workers in California for deportation, resulting in many of them not showing up for work for fear of detention.
I wonder how much longer the Trump administration will try to blame Biden for all of this stuff.
Oh, they'll keep trying forever. How's that sound? They will do so forever.
Yeah.
For the record, since it was a big deal when Trump ran on this during last year's campaign with a promise to bring prices down immediately, well, egg prices, they are up more than 27% over the past year. That would include the 6 months since Donald Trump has been in office. And finally, before I get to my guest today, since we'll be talking about taxes, a corporate lobbyist who for decades has helped major companies and wealthy Americans to dodge taxes, a man by the name of Ken Keyes, is now serving as the U.S. Treasury Department's top tax policy official, a position in which he will write the rules implementing the newly passed Republican budget law. That role is enormously powerful, the New York Times wrote in a Monday profile of Keyes, whom the GOP-controlled U.S. Senate confirmed as Assistant Treasury Secretary for Tax Policy in a party-line vote last month. The Republican budget measure, which Trump signed into law earlier this month, contains about $4.5 trillion in tax cuts that will flow disproportionately to the wealthiest Americans over the next decade. Quote, by putting a professional tax-dodging consultant in charge of their tax law, Republicans are continuing to make their intentions crystal clear. This law is a gift to billionaires and huge corporations like those Ken Keyes has spent his career looking out for, according to Lior Tal, the campaign director for the progressive advocacy group Unrig Our Economy, in a statement on Monday, adding, quote, as families struggle with rising prices from Trump's tariffs and face devastating cuts to Medicaid and SNAP, Republicans are doubling down on helping the richest of the rich while working people pay the price. In fact, in his role as lobbyist, whose clients had included Goldman Sachs, Pfizer, Microsoft, other huge corporate behemoths, Keyes has helped secure major tax giveaways for large companies and wealthy Americans, including the 2017 Trump GOP tax law that the new Republican budget will extend. According to the Times, in the George W. Bush administration, Keyes successfully pushed for legislation to make offshore tax dodges even easier to execute. During the Obama administration, he fended off an attempt to crack down on those strategies. In 2017, as part of a sweeping package of tax cuts signed by Trump, Keyes lobbied for a new tax break that provides a 20% deduction to certain businesses, which overwhelmingly, again, benefits the richest Americans. In his new position now, according to the Times. Keyes will oversee about 100 attorneys and economists at the Treasury Department's Office of Tax Policy. The office issues regulations to help the government administer tax laws, or not administer them, as the case may be, and it provides guidance that can render the latest tax dodging strategy to be a gold mine. Highlighting the Times profile of Keyes, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal wrote on Monday that the Trump administration is, quote, wallowing in corruption. Sounds about right. $5 trillion in tax cuts for the wealthiest, written and administered by the wealthiest, she wrote, on the backs of stripping health care and food from working and poor people. Shame on you, she said. The Washington Post Jeff Stein reported last week, on the heels of passage of that unpopular GOP budget law, right-wing organizations and Republican lawmakers are set to push the Trump administration to unilaterally, drastically reduce what investors pay on their capital gains. The plan rests on changing how the Treasury Department calculates those taxes. According to the Post, the highest earning 1% of Americans would receive 86% of the benefits from indexing capital gains to inflation, while the bottom 80% of income earners would get just 1% of those benefits. Congressman Brendan Boyle, Democrat of Pennsylvania, the top Democrat on the House Budget Committee, wrote in response to Stein's reporting that after gutting health care for millions of Americans and passing massive tax breaks for billionaires, Republicans are now working on even more tax breaks for the ultra rich. They aren't interested in fighting for working families, only their rich friends, said the congressman. Well, sounds about right. And now it seems the Trump administration has found yet another way.
Oh, goody.
To game the tax system to, at least they seem to believe, to help keep themselves in power by allowing houses of worship and other religious institutions, other tax-exempt institutions, for the first time to legally support or oppose political candidates, including from the church pulpit, if they wish, meaning, if I am understanding this correctly, that your tax dollars could essentially be helping to subsidize political candidates that you oppose. Longtime tax law professor Ellen April joins us next to help us wrap our heads around what this surprise announcement last week from the IRS in a court case down in Texas means and doesn't mean regarding dark money in elections and the separation between church and state. That is straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
Amen. Amen. Take me to church, I worship like a dog at the shrine of your life. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Americans, including religious Americans, generally take a very dim view of political endorsements from the pulpit. A 2019 survey by Pew Research found that 76% of Americans and 70% of Christians say that clergy should not endorse candidates from the pulpit, and nearly two-thirds of Americans wanted churches to stay out of politics altogether. That was back in 2019. According to a 2023 polling survey by the Public Religion Research Institute, majorities of all major religious groups oppose allowing places of worship to endorse political candidates while retaining their tax-exempt status. That includes white evangelicals at 62%, black Protestants at 59%, white mainline and non-evangelical Protestants at 77%, white Catholics 79%, Hispanic Catholics 78%, Jewish Americans 77%. Suffice to say, mixing religion with politics is not popular among the American people, pretty much anywhere, though it is somewhat more popular with white evangelicals and black Protestants, though even they oppose it. But when it comes to the president of the United States and enforcement of the so-called Johnson Amendment adopted in 1954, barring 501c3 nonprofit organizations from endorsing or opposing political candidates, well, Donald Trump, at least during his first term, he actively opposed that amendment as it applied to religious organizations, signing a 2017 executive order saying, quote, he would defend the freedom of religion and speech for the purposes of easing the Johnson Amendment's restrictions. And he vowed to, quote, get rid of and totally destroy the Johnson Amendment and allow our representatives of faith to speak freely and without fear of retribution, unquote. While the Johnson Amendment was never particularly well enforced during its nearly 75 years of existence, as I understand it, as of last week in a court filing by Trump's Internal Revenue Service, it seems that for the first time, if I'm understanding this correctly, it is now the official position of the U.S. government that it will not be enforced, at least against churches, even if other nonprofits, at least for now, will still be able to, will be unable to officially endorse or oppose candidates for public office. As NPR reported, what they described as a surprise announcement, quote, in a break with decades of tradition, the Internal Revenue Service says it will allow houses of worship to endorse candidates for political office without losing their tax-exempt status. The National Religious Broadcasters and several Texas churches sued the IRS over the rule, arguing that it infringes on their First Amendment rights to freedom of speech and the free exercise of religion. The New York Times reported that the plaintiffs that sued the IRS had previously asked a federal court in Texas to create an even broader exemption to rule that all nonprofits, religious and secular, were free to endorse candidates to their members. So I guess we should be grateful, perhaps, that this didn't go further, at least for now. Some Christian legal groups have long sought to overturn the Johnson Amendment without success until perhaps now. Americans United for Separation of Church and State, meanwhile, urged the judge in this case to reject the proposed settlement between the IRS and the religious group, saying in a statement, quote, weakening this law would undermine houses of worship and nonprofits by transforming them into political action committees, flooding our elections with even more dark money. No pun intended here, but Lord knows we do not need more dark money in politics, do we? Well, whether we do or not, that may be what is coming next amid the seemingly unending corruption of our political system in the Trump era. Ellen April, a professor emeritus at Loyola Law School in L.A., told the New York Times that she believes the IRS's decision would set off new debates about its limits, noting, quote, it's not going to be limited to just church members, she says, asking what happens when churches begin posting endorsements on their websites, quipping, even Las Vegas doesn't stay in Las Vegas these days. Everybody, she said, has a webpage. Fact check, true. Joining us now is Ellen April. She is now the senior scholar in residence at the Lowell Milken Center for Philanthropy and Nonprofits at the UCLA School of Law. She recently retired from Loyola Law School after 30 years, where she is the John Anderson Professor of Tax Law Emerita. She is also a fellow of the American College of Tax Counsel. Professor April, thank you for joining us today on the broadcast.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, unlike you, Ellen, I am not a tax or a law expert. So I first want to make sure that I've explained our story up to now generally accurately. Did I miss anything of note or get anything wrong there in that explanation?
So you are describing it the way that much of the media has covered it.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, it is not a new statement of general application from the IRS. It is simply a settlement of a particular case involving two plaintiffs,
mm-hmm.
two churches and the national religious broadcasters.
Mm-hmm.
And if the judge were to rule the way that the government and the plaintiffs have asked, it would enjoin enforcement of the Johnson Amendment for statements during worship connected to religious doctrine only for these two churches. It is not a general rule. In fact, the lawyers in the case, although representing the IRS, were Department of Justice lawyers,
mm-hmm.
not IRS lawyers. If we were to have a new general rule, it would have to come from the IRS in some form.
But if it were to apply, if the judge were to agree with this settlement, and it applied to these two churches and the religious broadcasters, how could that not then be applied by every other church that wished to make the case, citing this ruling in this particular case?
A settlement is not a ruling.
Okay.
Now, they may very well say, look, the settlement formalized what has always, not always, for many years mm-hmm. been the enforcement policy of the IRS. But this is not a precedent that they could cite to say it automatically gives me this privilege. Should the IRS ever go after any other church,
mm-hmm.
or let me say house of worship, to be a little more general?
Mm-hmm. But I mean, I guess we know that Donald Trump has made clear his feelings about the Johnson Amendment. He'd do away with it entirely. So I guess we can expect that the Trump administration, whether it's IRS or it's DOJ, will likely not go against churches who might violate the Johnson Amendment. But what you're suggesting is that this settlement is not law, and in future administrations, let's say Democratic ones, they could, if they wished, continue to enforce the Johnson Amendment.
Yes, I am anticipating something from the IRS along the lines of this settlement, however. I think that might be coming. I have no inside information on that.
Uh-huh.
But I think that it is possible. It concerns me. I do want to add as well, although you were very well informed in your introduction, Americans United for Separation of Church and State have now not only issued a statement about the case, they have filed a motion to intervene as a party,
mm-hmm.
which the other side opposes, or if the judge isn't willing to grant that over the opposition of the parties
mm-hmm.
to file an amicus brief
mm-hmm.
because they feel no one is defending the Johnson Amendment at the moment.
Right. And let's talk about that Johnson Amendment. It was first drafted by Lyndon B. Johnson when he was a senator in 1954. It is the law, right? It's not just a rule or a suggestion. It's actually a law. As I understand it, how unclear is it then, this particular law, that the IRS would essentially be able to say in court, yeah, we don't think it applies to the nonprofit status of churches, or at least these particular houses of worship?
So the joint motion and the proposed order from the plaintiffs and the DOJ rely on Establishment Clause decisions, mm-hmm. in particularly the decision in Catholic Charities of Wisconsin that just came down a few weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
saying that you cannot discriminate among denominations. And the order implies, although it never states it, which is one of my problems with the order, that endorsing candidates is essential under some church's doctrine. that they need to endorse candidates by name and not simply say, vote your values. We are for or against abortion. We are for or against climate change. So I find the joint motion and the order lacking in that regard, but that seems to be the basis. I think it ignores some important free exercise cases that say rule of general applicability applies to religious organizations and churches as well. Mm-hmm. And I very much hope that the judge lets Americans United for Separation and Church and State make these arguments in the case.
Depending if they're allowed to join the case, does this mean that even if the judge settles it, that they could appeal that decision on up the change?
No, a settlement cannot be appealed. Uh-huh. I spent a lot of time double checking that because I'm not a litigator.
Okay.
But hopefully, in my view, they would influence whatever order is issued. Mm-hmm. And the question also would be, if we did get some kind of official rule from the IRS, it is, depending on how it comes out, it's not clear to me who could challenge that in court.
Mm.
It's very hard when you have a pro-taxpayer ruling from the government who says, I'm harmed, and gets to go into court.
As I understand it, the Johnson Amendment over its 75 years or so has never been particularly well enforced, if at all, even though it has served as a deterrent of sorts. Is that the right way to look at it?
So in the middle 2000s, 2004 and 2006, the IRS did have a political activity compliance initiative. Mm. And they looked at many organizations, about half of which were church houses of worship, as I recall, mm-hmm. and did point out violations of the Johnson Amendment. And they sort of slapped everybody's hands and say, promise not to do this again. One of those cases involved the Episcopalian All Saints Church in Pasadena. Do you remember that one, Brett?
Somewhat, yeah.
So George Regas, the then retired head of the church, gave a sermon just a few days before the Bush-Kerry election, in which he said that he was comparing the two candidates. Uh-huh. He had praise and criticism for both of them, but it was clear whom he thought had the better argument at the end. And again, just before the election, naming candidates by name, and they were one of the incidents that the IRS investigated. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the church said, okay, we won't do this quite thing again.
Right. So it does come up every now and again.
There's another famous case.
Yeah.
I mean, only maybe famous to us tax people.
Yeah.
In which a church during Clinton's reelection took out full-page ads in two national newspapers mm-hmm. saying, don't vote for Clinton, he supports abortion. And they actually got their exemption revoked.
Right.
The D.C. Circuit revoked branch ministries exemption.
And I think that was the only time a church has ever gotten their tax exemption revoked under the Johnson Amendment, as I understand it. But
there's another case involving a religious organization that wasn't a church a little earlier, Christian Echoes, and they engaged both in a lot of lobbying, which 501c3s can only do to a limited extent, and some campaign intervention. The opinion emphasizes the lobbying violation, and it was a religious organization, not a church. The rules are different, and it did also lose its exemption.
Playing devil's advocate here, Ellen April, why shouldn't a church be allowed to express their view to its own, you know, parishioners from the pulpit about how to vote in elections and which candidates might be better for the church's own interests? What would be wrong with that? Isn't that just freedom of speech?
Part of the argument here is whether there is sufficient justification for the government to limit the speech of not only houses of worship, but any 501c3. Mm-hmm. Usually the argument is that there is a sufficient subsidy to these entities that permit this kind of limitation, both because they're exempt from income tax and because they can accept tax-deductible donations. Mm-hmm. That argument has gotten undermined a bit over the years. As an empirical matter, not as a theoretical matter, most members of churches take the standard deduction. Mm-hmm. So they don't actually get a tax benefit mm-hmm. from the charitable contribution deduction, although the big, beautiful bill just gave them a bit of a charitable contribution deduction. Mm-hmm. And the other issue that has arisen is that it's really cheap to engage in speech now. So in an era where 501c3 organizations, including churches, can do this so easily without spending any money, there is an argument that there isn't much of a subsidy, and we better find a different justification for the Johnson Amendment.
Well, and I think it's fair to say, Diane Yentl, the president of the National Council of Nonprofits, said last week that the IRS move was, quote, not about religion or free speech, but about radically altering campaign finance laws. She noted the decree could open the floodgates for political operatives to funnel money to their preferred candidates while receiving generous tax breaks at the expense of taxpayers who may not share those views. Now, no matter how much money that is right now, as you said, it's you know, pretty easy to run a campaign these days. But explain that her concern to me there, and because it feels that somehow I, as a taxpayer, whether it's a lot of money or not, could end up subsidizing groups that support a political candidate that I may oppose simply because they have that tax-exempt status.
Yes, there's an issue in doing it only for churches. Mm-hmm. So I would try to think of another group. I was trying to imagine how this could be challenged if it got officially announced. So imagine a new 501c3 that has very passionately held beliefs, pick your choice of the topic. And they say, during our usual channels of communication, which maybe are online meetings, we are going to endorse candidates. Mm-hmm. And then maybe they get their exemption application denied. Mm-hmm. And there is a provision that they can then seek a declaratory judgment from the tax court, the court of claims, or the DC district court. And they want to say, I don't see why you can do it for them and not for me.
Right.
And then I think the question becomes, they're really arguing for expanding the rule, not taking it away from houses of worship. So I don't know where that decision would come out.
It does seem like your comment to the New York Times, even Las Vegas doesn't stay in Las Vegas these days. It does sort of seem like once this horse is out of the barn, once churches are allowed to endorse, it seems like it would sort of be a no-brainer, especially, I got to say, for this Republican majority on this U.S. Supreme Court to sort of agree that any nonprofit should also have that right to endorse in elections. Why should it be limited to only houses of worship?
Yeah. Well, they're not too thrilled, this administration, with many 501c3s. We have all sorts of hearings happening, including one today from Homeland Security about charities that have aided undocumented immigrants, including Catholic charities. At one point, if they did too much of it, they would become a political organization under the tax code that has a different set of rules. But they'd have to do a whole lot of it. They have to be primarily involved in that. I do worry a lot about faux churches, faux houses of worship being formed just to get the tax deductible contributions. But I also wonder about the reasoning of this order about comparing it to a family, where I checked the largest mega churches. The largest mega church in the country has 76,000 members of the congregation. Doesn't sound like a family to me.
That's a pretty big family. But yeah, that was the IRS's argument they wrote in this court filing that when a house of worship, quote, in good faith speaks to its congregation through its customary channels of communication on matters of faith in connection with religious services concerning electoral politics viewed through the lens of religious faith, it neither participates nor intervenes in a political campaign. Rather, the IRS said that it compared religious institutions' endorsements of candidates to a simple family discussion, saying, quote, thus communication from a house of worship to its congregation in connection with religious services through its usual channels do not run afoul of the Johnson Amendment as properly interpreted.
And why that would be different from some non-houses of worship, I don't know. I would point out, you know, you can have any discussion you want within your family. Mm-hmm. If a family creates a family foundation that is exempt under 501c3, all of a sudden they're subject to this prohibition too. There's a difference once you become an entity. I have trouble with the way the order defined intervene to mean interfere. That's not the only meaning of intervene. Mm. They said that participate means take part in. I don't see how endorsing a candidate is not taking part in. Mm. But I also think the definitions they offered, any 501c3 should say, well, that gives me permission to do the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, is it fair to say, in short, that allowing churches to endorse candidates effectively makes political contributions tax deductible, especially when you're talking about, you know, contributions to these mega churches, which, you know, you talk about 76,000 members.
I think the next one was 45,000. The 76th one was extraordinarily big.
Yeah, I mean, they have the resources already to play a huge part in our elections. And frankly, they already do, even without this official endorsement from the IRS to do so, as I see it. But I mean, essentially, this can be set up in such a way that, well, make your political endorsements with a church, then it becomes tax deductible, and you still get to make your same political point. Isn't that what the concern ultimately is here?
That's a large part of the concern. I double-checked the Federal Election Commission campaign financing rules. You have to report endorsements or opposition if you spend an entity over $250 a year. It would take an awful lot of sermons if you allocated the minutes spent doing that for the heating and the cooling and the minister's salary. So whether they would get caught by the FEC seems unlikely, but I do want to point out that unlike other 501c3s, houses of worship do not have to file to become tax exempt. They do not have to file the annual information return that other 501c3s do. That means disclosing how much they got involved, if at all, in campaign intervention or lobbying.
Wow.
And there are additional procedural hurdles before the IRS can examine a church.
So that would really become dark money once we start heading down that road. To that end, Ellen, before I wrap up here, I mean, it does seem like, you know, the line between both churches and elections and nonprofits in general and elections has already become incredibly blurred, particularly with the invention of these, you know, so-called political action committees that are often little more than offshoots of political groups. Correct me if you see it differently, but if that is the case, will this pronouncement about religious groups, if it is approved by the judge and generally accepted, this proposed settlement from the IRS, ultimately, do you see it making a huge difference in our elections moving forward, or are we already down that dark road of dark money and so forth?
I think it depends just how much we would be able to discover these false entities that arise as houses of worship just to do this work. That's what really worries me here.
Yeah. And I guess it will take an IRS and a Department of Justice who actually wants to discover those things.
as well as has the resources to do it. Going after every church during election season would take an awful lot of IRS resources.
Yes, it would. And as we've seen in the past, it usually takes years to do so anyway. And that horse is already out of the barn as well by the time the elections are done. Ellen April is the senior scholar in residence at the Lowell Milken Center for Philanthropy and Nonprofits at the UCLA Law School. She recently retired from Loyola Law School here in L.A., where she is the John E. Anderson Professor of Tax Law Emerita. She can be found on the Blue Skies at Ellen April with two L's at the end of April. Ellen, really appreciate you joining us today and helping us to understand what seems like a nightmare, but maybe it's not quite as bad as it seemed, or maybe it's just another nightmare we'll add to the list at this point. Thank you so much, Ellen.
You're very welcome. It was a very great pleasure.
Thank you. All right, well, I'm glad we sort of got that a little bit cleared up.
Yeah.
Because everybody in the media was saying, oh, you can do it right now. You're free to, rabbis, pastors, priests are free to endorse anyone they want from the pulpit. Well, not quite. At least not yet.
Right. And I can see it being a place where folks take advantage of that lack of consistency. I could foresee pastors, say, endorsing a political candidate. And then, you know, if they get investigated, then they can ask for forgiveness later. But they can roll in the political dollars and the billionaires can get that tax deduction for a political speech.
And in the meantime, the Trump administration is sending a signal. They ain't going to prosecute anybody for that. They're not going to take away anyone's tax exempt status for that. So go ahead, endorse all you want, give all the money you want, although, you know, you might run a risk of a real administration returning to power someday in the future and holding you to account for, you know, actually violating the law once the law and order is actually returned to the U.S. after the
if we're lucky enough for that, yes.
Speaking of which, sort of, as we were talking with Ellen there, news breaks that Donald Trump is finally pulling about 2,000 California National Guard troops that he federalized here in Los Angeles. He's pulling them out. Now that they have all saved the day, they have done nothing of the sort. They showed up, of course, you may recall, amid demonstrations here in L.A., over Donald Trump's immigration policies. The New York Times reports that the release of about 2,000 members of the Guard 79th Infantry Brigade combat team had comes as officials in California had pushed for an end to what the White House had suggested would be a 60-day mobilization. The infantry team was federalized by Trump and dispatched on June 7 in the wake of chaotic protests. Chaotic but not deadly protests. These guys, you know, it was completely under control.
Yeah.
Essentially, the National Guard was here wasting your taxpayer dollars, not doing anything that the LAPD could not already do.
Yeah, it was a big theatrical stunt.
Which Donald Trump, I got to give him credit, does very well. He's good with the big theatrical stunts.
Yep.
With reality, not so much. Anyway, 2,000 are being now returning to what they were doing previously, which was helping to fight wildfires, something where we actually need these folks. Not standing around in front of federal buildings that nobody is even bothering to visit with, you know, rifles looking like tough guys. It was just stupid. But
yep. Stupid fascism.
Yeah, well, that's one thing Donald Trump does very well. Hey, speaking of wildfires, unfortunately, let's take a quick break here. And we will come back with Desi Doyen and our latest Green News Report. That's straight ahead on your broadcast today. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is supporting you and the things that you care about. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. right now as much as ever. If you choose to support us, you can do it really easily, safely, and quickly via bradblog.com/donate. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
All right, Desiree, it has been a rough few weeks, it seems, for the old Green News Report.
Yes, and for the United States, lots of extreme weather all over the place.
Yeah, and I would add for the planet, as is once again the case in our latest Green News Report.
What is different about Texas is that FEMA operated how President Trump wanted it to operate.
Outrage grows over Trump administration's delayed FEMA response to deadly Texas flood disaster. As new flash flooding strikes around the U.S., new data reveals inadequacy of FEMA flood maps. Plus,
flames from a fast-moving wildfire at the north rim of the Grand Canyon destroyed a historic century-old lodge this weekend.
Grand Canyon fire allowed to burn destroys a national park treasure.
All of those disasters and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
So I think some of what you saw for our response in Texas is going to be a lot of how President Trump envisions what FEMA would look like into the future.
That's exactly what we're worried about, Christy Noem. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, another weekend of disaster and destruction, it seems.
Yes, unfortunately, the U.S. saw several more rounds of intense rainfall and flash flood alerts across parts of the Midwest and into the Northeast over the weekend and throughout the night on Monday, part of an unusual surge of extreme storms in the days since the historic catastrophic flooding in the Texas Hill Country on July 4th. There, as well, more waves of extreme rainfall and flash floods halted search and recovery efforts over the weekend, with at least 129 people now confirmed dead. A wave of new reporting has exposed more massive gaps in the nation's risk management and emergency preparedness and response systems. AP reports that federal regulators repeatedly granted appeals by the owners of Camp Mystic, where dozens of young girls were killed, to loosen oversight and allow them to expand into a dangerous floodplain, despite it being a high-risk area, in part because it would have required costly flood insurance. Now, new data from nonprofit climate risk firm First Street has underscored the inadequacy of FEMA's outdated flood maps across the country, revealing that more than twice as many Americans live in flood-prone areas than FEMA's flood maps currently show. FEMA's maps have failed to take rainfall and flash flood flooding into account, even as climate change is supercharging rainfall intensity. But the agency has lacked the mandate and funding from Congress to address it. Outrage continues to grow over Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem's response to the disaster and her curtailment of FEMA. Although she immediately showed up on camera in Texas, Noem waited until 3 days after the floods to finally approve requests for FEMA water rescue teams. That was due to a new policy she instituted requiring her personal approval on every contract over $100,000. Red tape that anonymous FEMA officials say cost lives and will cause untenable delays in the future.
She didn't approve water rescue crews for 3 days?
Yes. And the New York Times reports that only 15% of phone calls from flood victims to FEMA's assistance hotline were answered because Noem fired hundreds of call center employees after failing to renew their contracts the day after the floods.
And Noem keeps holding this up as an example of how Donald Trump will be dealing with disasters in the future, like she's proud of it.
Critics say the Trump administration degrading FEMA's response is a preview of their effort to dismantle the agency and force states to shoulder most of the burden and cost of emergency response and recovery as called for in Project 2025, even as extreme weather disasters become more frequent due to man-made climate change. Contrary to the administration's claims, states have always overseen disaster response, with FEMA playing a supporting role. Plus, as Democratic Governor Josh Stein of North Carolina explained on CNN, it's just bad risk management to dismantle FEMA.
We don't get a huge storm every year. The country does. It doesn't make sense for each state to have a fully staffed emergency response team because they may not have a storm for 5 years or 10 years, but we know the country will. So let's have that expertise in the federal government.
And finally, in Arizona, a fast-moving, wind-driven wildfire sparked by lightning destroyed up to 80 buildings on the north rim of the Grand Canyon on Sunday, including the historic, century-old Grand Canyon Lodge. In a tragic cascade of events, the Trump National Park Service reportedly allowed the fire to spread unchecked for days as a controlled burn at the height of the summer fire season. Then the fire damaged a water treatment plant, releasing a toxic plume of chlorine gas, forcing the evacuation of fire crews and visitors. The North Rim will remain closed for the rest of the year.
And the disasters are only beginning, I fear. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. All right. Thank you very much, Desiree.
Yes, and a bit of a slightly more positive follow-up to that. The Grand Canyon Historical Society has posted photos of the Grand Canyon Lodge on the North Rim that was burned by fire.
Yep.
And good news, the stones, the stone walls and the foundation are still standing, mostly still there, and they vow that they will rebuild, although it will take many, many, many years.
It will indeed.
But at least the bones are still there.
It was sort of half stone, half wood, great big, huge, beautiful logs. The logs are gone, I guess. But
very rustic, very gorgeous, very historic. I'm so glad I got the chance to see it myself, but it will hopefully be rebuilt.
Someday.
Yeah.
So there's that. Thank you very much for brightening things up at the end here, Desi Doyen, our producer. My thanks as well to our guest today, Professor Ellen April of Loyola, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other since the beginning of time, you can download them all for free at bradblog.com, where there is no paywall, thanks to those of you who hit a donate button when you stop by. You can also go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves and, as I will continue to promise for a while, hopefully upgrade our website eventually, soon, I hope. Anyway, thanks in advance for all of that. Drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and you'll find me on the social medias, especially Blue Sky at the Brad Blog. You'll find Desi there as well. She is
at Green News Report.
There you go. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.